many, many podcasts. My name is Richie. I'm sitting here with my two friends, Michael and Amy, hailing from the great state of Missouri. I think that's north of Florida, like somewhere. So what this podcast kind of aiming to do, you know, this is kind of like the first one. We're definitely going to kind of take a couple movies. Like today, we're going to talk about The Amazing Spider-Man, you know, our thoughts about it the entire way. We've got some different angles, and then hopefully we get some great conversation going on. If you like something, you know, post on here at all. If you like any opinions about like movies, if you agree with us, if you disagree with us the entire way, we'll probably have different people from time to time come along, and I think this is going to be a really, really good thing. So let's go ahead and introduce the other ones first. Mike, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself?
Hey, I'm Mike. I'm out here in Missouri. Me and Richie go back a long way, and I'm a big movie fan. I've been a movie fan forever, so we figured we'd get together and talk about movies. If you want to get a hold of me, my Twitter handle is mpusatera, P-U-S-A-T-E-R-A, on Twitter. So hit me up there, and we'll respond to anything you guys have.
Very, very nice. Amy, what about you?
I'm Amy, and I am new to this group. I met Richie through Mike, and so also new to the superhero groupie. I always liked movies, so watch more movies now than I ever have, though, thanks to Mike. So this is fun, though. I'm excited.
Very, very cool. And my name, again, is Richie, and I am a big, 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 big fan of movies. You know, I said probably about, you know, maybe about, I want to say 15 years ago, you know, when the first movies started coming out, like Blade and X-Men, you know, these are kind of like, you know, reveling in like these great, the things that you read in comic books the entire way around, you know, you knew that they could be translated in the screen world, but maybe you thought that it wasn't at the right time because maybe technology wasn't present. We've seen some horrible versions of superhero movies that have been done back in the day, but we've seen some great ones. You know, I will even still say like Batman in 1990, Tim Burton's Batman, although it was his direction. I'm not necessarily a big fan of Tim Burton, and I'm sure Mike will probably hate me on some of the other movies on that as well. But those are a great example of how, you know, comics could really, really kind of transcend. And so you take Batman from, like, the 1990s, transfer it into, like, The Dark Knight, and Batman Begins. If, by the way, we're watching the NFL draft that this podcast is going on, so if you hear a little jingle, that's what that is, by the way. So let's go ahead and start off with The Amazing Spider-Man. It's the sequel to The Amazing Spider-Man, which came out in 2012, which stars Andrew Garfield as a Tellier character, Emma Stone as the Gwen Stacy, who I'm happy was actually added to the story. And let's just go ahead right off the bat, like, you know, Amy, we'll start with you since, you know, you're kind of like the more outside perspective. I don't know if you had any wants and desire to see this, but what did you think while watching the movie? You know, was it something that, like, spoke to you in certain volumes, you know, like what do you wish overall impression, just overall, nothing too specific yet, but just overall.
So not spoilery yet?
Yeah, I guess we can go like not spoilery. Yeah, let's go ahead and like not give too much away for those who haven't seen it. I mean, you know, it's kind of like the Titanic, you kind of know what's going to happen, maybe, but you don't know how it's going to happen. So we can kind of go from like that perspective, you know, like where you moved basically by what happened. So go for it, Amy.
I mean, having seen the first one, I knew kind of going in that the characters, the development of the characters was really good, and I liked the relationship between Emma Stone and Andrew Garfield. I think they're great on film, so I was excited to see more of their story and see what happens with them. So, I mean, as far as that goes, I was definitely not disappointed. I think it was great. There was probably more of that than I expected in the movie, but not in a bad way. There was still plenty of action, which was great. It kind of broke it up, but, you know, you got just enough, and then it would kind of switch pacing. So that was nice. So I really liked it.
Very, very cool. Nice little person. Mike, what do you think overall, kind of like the entire movie impressions? So.
Yeah, so I really enjoyed the first version of this series with Emma Stone and Andrew Garfield and Sally Field was the new Aunt May. I felt like it had a lot more heart than the original Sam Raimi trilogy with, from 10 years ago. I liked this movie a lot. I really felt like it tugged it at your heartstrings and made you go through a wide range of emotions. There were some things I would say that it rushed through. Even though it was long, it didn't feel long, but there was a lot of a lot of things going on, and it probably could have been better, even though I really liked it, had they, you know, maybe done this movie as a movie and a half, and stuck some of the stuff maybe the next one. I, as everybody sort of has said, you know, kind of around the internet, I think Emma Stone and Andrew Garfield, obviously they're a real life couple, and I think that their chemistry is palpable on screen, and it drags you in there in a way that I don't think I've seen very often in movies. Certainly not common. The movie is at its best when they're together on screen.
Oh yeah, absolutely, like the entire way. So,
and I thought it made good progress with their relationships. I thought a lot of the new characters worked really well. It's very big and entertaining, and so I liked it. I thought it was good.
Yeah, you know, I kind of called this movie, kind of like the beginning of the 2014 summer blockbusters. You know, or maybe like unofficially like summer. It's always usually that beginning of May movies that really kind of like sets the tone off, and we'll have a couple of other bigger ones coming up like over the course of the summer. I mean, you have Transformers, that's going to be a really, really big one, summer blockbuster. Guardians of Galaxy, of course, that's going to be coming out in August. That's the second of the Marvel ones, and that'll actually be the last movie before next year's The Avengers Age of Ultron, so that's going to be pretty exciting the way that universe is. So, you know, I thought that The Amazing Spider-Man was, of course, for what it was, for what you were given, you know, it's, again, I'm a huge fan of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and I like the interaction of characters. The chemistry between Andrew Garfield or Peter Parker and Gwen Stacy, that's what was missing from Sam Raimi's like version, you know. So there are certainly some great things about that. I thought some of the characters were great. I thought some weren't needed. And then as far as the canon of the film, I talked to Mike with this previously when we were kind of talking about what we want to do for podcasts. I actually disagreed a lot with the version. I felt like they kind of pigeonholed themselves. And that's actually, let's go ahead and like actually go into that one. And Mike kind of touched on it a little bit. So Mike, let me ask you. So you have like the choice of like actors in this. So what do you like about having Andrew Garfield as Peter Parker, just him by himself?
Well, I mean, I think he shines when he's got the suit on. I'm not, you know, the comic reader fan. I really just like the movies, and I like the spectacular aspect of it. But I do know Spider-Man some from, you know, cartoons and things as a kid, and I know he's supposed to be kind of a smartass. And I think Garfield captures that better than the previous iterations did. Mm-hmm. But his ability, he's a world-class actor. I think you're going to see him in a lot of stuff after this. He's really able to drag you into everything that he's feeling just with his face and with his eyes. There's several incredibly powerful scenes in this movie. He's in all of them. And his facial expression and acting is superb in every single one. What I would say, where I would say there, you know, I can understand why some people might take some issue, or not maybe be buying into him quite as much, is he's a good looking guy. He's much more debonair. There's a couple of scenes in this movie that do not fit into the sort of nerdy stereotype that Peter Parker has, and I think it's okay in his presentation, but I can understand how, you know, some traditional fans might be upset by that. But I totally buy it. It totally works for me. Mm-hmm. And I could watch him on screen in anything. And I should say, I come into this without having seen him really in a lot of other movies. I didn't see The Social Network, which I know he was in. But this is a really well-acted movie. The quality of the actors in it is very high.
Mm-hmm. I like that. So, Amy, so touching on what Mike said, you know, did you feel that anything was kind of like forced? Like, did you like to end that? Maybe talk about more about like the chemistry between him and like Emma Stone. Like, are you a fan of Emma Stone? Like, outside?
Yeah, it's funny because Mike and I were talking about this the other day, because everything I had seen her in prior to this, she was the typical, you know, blonde ditzy girl, you know, just a face, and you know, and I really like her because she's so smart in this, and you know, that's one of the things that I really like about Gwen Stacy's characters, that she gives it right back to, you know, to Peter as much as she gets, and I love that about their chemistry. So I hadn't really seen her in anything that I really liked her in. So you didn't really get to see the depth of the her character and how, you know, her range as an actress. So that part's interesting for me. I only found out, I guess it was like a week or two ago, from Mike that they were together off, you know, had no idea they were actually together as a couple, which makes a lot more sense, but you don't see that type of chemistry in most movies where it's very genuine and doesn't feel forced or, you know, awkward. Sure. One of the things I really like about Andrew Garfield versus, you know, others that I've seen in this role is his quirkiness. It's not so much nerdy quality. He's very quirky and, you know, just he's different. And I like that about him. So, I mean, I really liked him as Peter Parker. I think he was a great, you know, I guess, he is a good-looking guy, but he's still, there's enough awkwardness about him that I think he fits the role, you know, perfectly.
Absolutely. Yeah, I couldn't agree more with both of you as far as what both of those, you know, being like the main two leads coming in to the movie, you know, there's a certain weight about these characters. Like, I think a lot of, especially comic book fans like myself, you know, to kind of come into the... you know, to this world, you know, because there's so many, the level of expectations, you know, for the fans as well as people who haven't. And that's a really, really, and I think that's probably the hardest part about this whole entire thing is how do you really, really bring these characters into a way that's, you know, semi-believable for what the universe is, but being able to bring, like, an emotional quality into it. So, you know, one of the other characters who came to this was having Jamie Foxx come in, and I tell you what, I've always been like either he's so on or he's not off. You know, Jamie Foxx, I remember watching him back in the early days of In Living Color.
Mm-hmm.
When he came into the scene, you know, that show was mainly Jim Carrey, Damon Wayans, you know, Keenan to a certain extent, Tommy Davis, and a lot of characters. And Jamie Foxx didn't really come in until like the kind of like the subsequent seasons. But my goodness, when he came in, his depth of character. So we know the guy's got talent. If you've seen movies like Ray, if you've seen any of the other movies that he's been in, the guy's got, and he's a really, really talented guy. Like, he's a musician. He's a triple threat to, like, a certain degree. Like, there was a little while where he had, like, his music. But, man, from the get-go, I was really, really worried that, you know, I was telling Mike about this, that it was getting to that Jim Carrey-esque level of character when he was started playing Matt Dillon's, like, character. So, the character of Matt Dillon, you know, is Electro. He is well-known as far as the actual, like, character himself, but, you know, it's, you know, there's always a question about, you know, who's going to, like, play, who's going to bring, like, character to life, you know, how far do you go off of the original, like, material, and, you know, Max Dillon was really one of those. I mean, if you ever look at the costume in the comics, he's got that green, like, spandex, and he's got those, like, lightning bolts. It's easy to go cheesy, and it almost fell in that direction. But once he kind of, like, transformed, I felt he started getting underutilized. Like, you know, he went from, like, this bumbling person that all of a sudden having, like, these powers gave him this super suave, you know, confidence. The special effects were fantastic, but I just feel that maybe he could have been given a little bit more depth as far as his character. What do you think about that, Amy?
Well, not knowing the backstory of the character... I don't have kind of that take on it, so I have no idea. I think it's a good character to take. You know, you take this guy who, you know, by all rights is a very kind-hearted and just wants to be understood and be liked and, you know, have somebody remember his name and, you know, and through no fault of his own, you know, this thing happens to him. And, you know, even in the beginning, he's not trying to hurt anybody. He's trying to, you know, make sense of it, but the world around him it no longer, and then it, you know, he falls victim to, because of the strength that he has and what he's able to do, he's able to get revenge on, you know, these people that have wronged him, or in his mind he's felt wronged. But I thought Jamie Foxx did a good job portraying the character. I totally expected it to be much cheesier from the previews. I had no idea, actually, having seen the previews, that was Jamie Foxx, because you don't see him prior to his transformation in the previews. So I didn't realize that was him. I mean, I found out before we went in, but not too long before that, I was like, oh, that'll be interesting, because, like you said, he can be really good, or he can be, you know, this is I thought he did a good job. I like the character development. I like that you get to see the transformation. Kind of, you feel for the guy, you know?
Yeah, there's like a certain level of empathy for the character. You know, it's hard for, like, you know, for these kind of movies, like, sometimes, like, the power is great, but, like, kind of, like, where do you go? So, Mike, so we talked earlier about, you know, so the character of Max Dillon. So you have two other villains in the story as well. So you have Dane DeHaan, who basically played Harry Osborn, who's the son of Norman Osborn, who is the original Green Goblin. And then to a very, very small degree, you have Paul Giamatti as the Rhino, or their version of the Rhino. What did you think overall about having those, about the actors like behind it, and do you feel that they were underused? Because that's definitely where I'm coming from. So what do you think about that?
Right, so, right. So this gets into the more is not always more. I liked all of the villains. I thought that, well, Paul Giamatti I thought was really fun.
Sure.
I mean, it totally worked for me. I know that it's not what the source is about at all, but it was totally fun. The first opening scene with him is hysterical, and I liked the, again, with the humor and the sort of sarcastic Spider-Man with the pulling down his pants and stuff and everything. And you know, scene that sort of bookends the movie with him, where he's, you know, yelling in like a Russian accent or something, and he's laughing and hysterical. And the Rhino suit, even though it was totally silly and cheesy, was really fun, I thought. The movie could have totally lived without him in any of the scenes, and it wouldn't have really been missing anything. But he was still fun. Dane DeHaan is maybe the best actor in the whole movie, and that's saying something.
Sure, watching
him paint a room. I don't know if it's something he works on or if it's something he's naturally gifted with, but when he smiles in a scene, you can just feel the wheels and the cogs turning in his head with his plans. He was the shining star of Chronicle, and that was a movie filled with great performances as well. And it was a perfect sort of analog to this because it was a sci-fi effects movie where there wasn't a lot of sci-fi or effects. A lot of it was implied. And he was able to carry it, you know, with his level of acting. And I think he does it perfectly here. He's probably at his worst when he's actually transformed into the Green Goblin, just because the Green Goblin is kind of a silly character to begin with. A lot of Spider-Man's villains are silly, but the Green Goblin might be the silliest with his crazy pumpkins and all that. And I just watched it again this afternoon, and I liked it again. And there is a pumpkin. He does actually throw a very small little pumpkin toward the end of the movie at one of the climax scenes, which I thought was kind of funny. But he's really good. His scene with his father, which is completely different than the scene with his father. In fact, his entire character is laid out almost entirely in the previews, except the scenes that they show of him in the previews don't appear at all in the movies. They're in the same place and the same time, but they're different, which is very strange. I'm wondering if the studio made there be a cut of this movie that wasn't the original intent of Webb or the other producers. I don't really know, but I really like Dane DeHaan. I thought he did a great job. He's a good, evil, almost lovable guy. It certainly would have been better, I feel, if with the way the movie turned out. I felt like it would have been better without probably Electro in it, tell the same story, but just have more of the Peter Parker, Harry Osborn interaction, and then some of the things that happen later in the film, and maybe we'll go into spoilers pretty soon so we can say what those things are. You know, some of those things would have had more weight or made more sense given there being more time, a couple more scenes between them to sort of flesh that out. I think that might have been helpful.
Well, I'm glad that you kind of brought up that point about, you know, the canon, I guess, of this entire series. And this will actually, we'll lead into this conversation about, like, where the overall, like, universe. So, but really quickly, the last thing as far as, like, we'll get out of the character actors, I'd be remiss if we didn't talk about Sally Field's performance. So,
Yes.
Sally Field is ridiculous. You know, she reminds me of I couldn't even like I forgot who it was. There's a movie character that came out. It was the guy who plays, I can't think of his name right now. He was in The Matrix, like the first one. He was in a couple like these other movies, and what basically the director said that like he's my good luck charm, and I feel the same way about Sally Field. Whenever you put her like into
Bill
a movie,
Pantoliano?
I'm sorry,
Bill Pantoliano.
I think so. Is that like the short little guy? Like he played like the villain in like The Matrix, something like that.
He was in Sopranos.
Yeah, I think so. Well, yeah. I forget what director what it was, but they basically said that like he's like their good luck charm. Like he's in a movie, it's gonna do good. And I feel the same way about Sally Field. You know. You put Sally Field into especially a movie like this, and there's a certain credibility. Even in the first one where she was with Martin Sheen, and they had to play, you know, Uncle Ben, you know, Aunt May the entire way around. So, Amy, I want to ask you, you know, like, were you moved at all, you know, like, by her performances? Like, did you feel that, you know, that she was definitely, like, in the character, or did you feel it was more like Sally Field just playing, like, another character? What were your thoughts on that?
I thought she did a great job. I mean, Sally Field, I am totally there with you as far as her caliber. She's one of those actresses that, because she doesn't take just any role, you know, she's very selective about what, and by all rights, she has that opportunity to be selective, that you know you're going to, it's a good story and it's a good character, or she wouldn't take it. And I thought the scene, and, you know, Mike and I have talked about this, the scene with her and Peter on the bed in his room when they're talking about, when Peter's trying to get her to open up about what about his dad and that story, and just her... the raw emotion there. I mean, it's just, it's palpable and you feel it's very, you almost get lost and you feel like this is really, it's no longer a movie and these are not characters. These are real people. Which I think, you know, anytime a movie can bring you in like that, that's spectacular. So,
yeah,
but I think we need to talk about this cause this was a really powerful scene for him. I know.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that. And, Mike, what we won't talk about, you know, when we're talking about not doing spoilers is what, we won't talk about the other big emotional scene like of the movie, which would be pretty evident to anyone else. But tell me what you felt about like that particular scene, what it said about the dynamic of the movie and their relationship.
Sure. So, yeah, I love her. I've liked her in most everything I've ever seen her in. And I guess I just went and watched the movie again. I saw it on the preview night on Thursday a week ago, and I saw it today because I was off work. And there are some things in the way that she there are some really smart choices that she makes in how she presents her version of Aunt May. And one of the things I like about these movies now is that the women aren't stupid. In Man of Steel, for instance, Lois Lane is an investigative reporter, and an investigative reporter wouldn't be thrown by glasses. She would know that it's Clark Kent, right? And you know, Gwen knows that it's Spider-Man, and Aunt May knows too. You know, Aunt May knows, and she lets you know in little ways. But that scene that Amy's referencing on the bed where it's a vehicle for them to advance the mystery that was set up in the first movie relating to Peter's parents and what happened to them and why they dropped him off and where they went. And the opening of the movie obviously deals with some of that, too. She's spectacular, and so is Andrew Garfield in that scene.
Yeah.
It's extremely difficult to watch that without getting choked up.
Yeah.
Her performance and the way that she portrays her feelings and her frustrations with all this stuff that's happened to him and everything that's happened in her life, it all falls out of her. And the way that they react to each other, it's, you know, it's very difficult to realize that you have a 67-year-old woman and a kid from England that came together on set and don't spend a lot of time together. They feel like they've been living together for years.
And it's effortless.
It's incredible. It's incredible, and it brings it out of you. Whether you like the movie or not, there's no one that could have not been affected by that scene.
All right, so this is what is going to segue into like my next thing, and I think this is where we're probably going to have a little bit, a couple of like disagreements about like this movie. So as I said before, you know, like I'm a big proponent of canon and everything, you know, so I think part of the success of why Amazing... Oh, not the draft. I think the success of Amazing Spider-Man 2 and Sony for having that franchise, the Amazing Spider-Man is going to have to rely on its acting ability, which is why they brought in the people that they did. It's kind of like the same choices. When Anthony Hopkins came in as Odin on Thor, automatically there was an air of the gravity of acting just basically went up. Same thing, I think, with having Sally Field, Andrew Garfield, you know, Martin Sheen, and to an extent Emma Stone coming into that franchise. We'll get into X-Men later. That's another big blockbuster that's going to come up this summer. X-Men, I think, Days of the Future Past, which is one of the great storylines. That franchise tends to rely on a lot of star power. Now, there's some great acting in there. You have Michael Fassbender, you have Patrick Stewart. And we'll get into that. That's the whole entire can of worms to open up. And then you have the Marvel Cinematic Universe, which has Robert Downey Jr., you know, Chris Hemsworth, Chris Evans, who just did Captain America. So for me, the canon of things, and it's so sad that each one of these elements, you know, you have Spider-Man, X-Men, and the Marvel Cinematic Universe. In my opinion, Marvel Cinematic gets it right because they did what comics do, you know. You had individual storylines, but then every so often they would cross over. You would catch them in each other's comic books, and I really, really like the aspect. A lot of people thought it may not work, but then it's an element that only Marvel is pulling off. And if you see with the latest iteration of Captain America, you know, it's spectacular, you know, how like they take each one of these characters, but then you love them when they go in together. So my problem with Amazing Spider-Man 2, I would probably akin it to three major notes, and I don't know if you guys want to keep track of those. So the first one was the choice of the paper. Write it down. What do you want me to do? Mike, tell me what you want me to do here.
I'm taking notes.
Oh, you are taking notes. Well, good.
I'm taking notes about your three things. One.
So the three things to keep track of is basically the choice of having Harry Osborn be the original Green Goblin and not Norman Osborn. And I felt that took away from because in the comic book lines, you had, you know, Norman Osborn kind of didn't, you know, there's like this, he's basically like Joker Batman, Green Goblin Spider-Man. Norman Osborn and conflicting, and Peter Parker knowing that it was Norman Osborn, sets up his friendship with Harry Osborn when they eventually get to college. They don't even meet in high school. They don't even meet until college. So I felt by using Harry, you kind of close off a whole entire dynamic. And eventually Harry Osborn will become, you know, the Goblin down the road. That ties into the second one. I didn't like how Mary Jane wasn't added into the storyline quite yet. And that, if you're talking about character, that's a really, really major. And in fact, they casted Mary Jane for this role. If I'm not mistaken, looking online, they casted for the role of Mary Jane. I'm sorry?
Jaylene Woodley.
Yes, and they actually cut out her scenes because they felt like it would be stepping too much into the whole entire Gwen storyline and like whatever. And then the third thing that kind of bothers me about the canon of it is when it all takes place. You know, it's a lot of this is, I guess, right at graduation or whatever, until like well afterwards. You know, all these like I don't know if it's a product of Sony having to output these movies, but I feel like they just kind of close themselves off as far as any like future storylines. So now, Amy, you kind of said like this was kind of like your, you know, that you didn't really come to this. So having that perspective, what did you think about the overall, like, are these, I guess maybe, did you not notice, like, the canon, or do you kind of take it for what it is, or can you see that they can go places with this franchise from an outsider's perspective, not knowing, like, the comics or anything like that? Do you feel like they had, like, enough material and, like, little teasers? Could you feel it, or no?
Well, I mean, you've got Rhino and you've got Green Goblin. So, I mean, there's a storyline there that can go somewhere. I don't know a whole, you know, enough about the dynamic of Norman Osborn and what they're, you know, obviously he worked with Peter Parker's father, and so there's the history there. I don't remember much about Harry being in it. He wasn't even in the first one at all, right?
I don't believe that his character wasn't in the
any
first
reference or anything, you know. So for them coming back, that was kind of awkward for me because I didn't kind of have anything to reference for that. But sure. I don't know. I think with any of these type of things, you know, there's always plenty of bad guys out there that they can bring in, you know, to the storyline. So you don't have to always. I guess it's easy for me to not get to just enjoy the story because I don't have anything to reference it to where it's gonna like bother me when they change it. Now, when it comes to other movies that I've read the books, and then they a book that I really love, and then they change something or they take something out that I thought was, you know, pivotal to the book, and then it's not in the movie, it drives me crazy. So I can totally understand that perspective. Like, you know, if you're the love of the story and then they change it in the movie, that being an issue for, you know, the comic book lovers and stuff like that. But I don't, it's hard for me to understand that because I don't have that backstory and that relationship with the comics the way that, you know, like you would.
Example of, like, do you know of any, like, books that you've read where they've absolutely just completely missed the mark when they did, like, a film version or anything like that? I mean, I don't know how in-depth you want to get for any, like, storyline. There's anything off the top of your head that would be a really, really good example outside of, like, these types of, like, franchises, so we can kind of, like, relate it to, for other those people out there who maybe may not know about comics, you know, like, so they can get an idea of maybe how I'm feeling about.
Yeah.
Well, I can tell you one right off the top of my head that's pretty personal to me.
Yeah.
The end of The Lost World, the second Jurassic Park movie, does not contain a giant dinosaur roaming around San Diego in the Michael Crichton original book.
Is that true? I won't lie to you. I read any of Michael Crichton's books.
Sphere.
At all. Is it? Is it worth reading? Like, how are the books set up for that universe, just real quick? Is it all based off of one book, or is there a series of books?
So the first Jurassic Park is based off of the Jurassic Park novel that was written in the late 80s, and then they asked him to write a second book. And in the original book, Ian Malcolm, the Jeff Goldblum character, dies. And
okay.
So they kept him alive in the movie, so he had to invent a way to get him back alive for the sequel book. But the book, the second book, deals with a lot of interesting things, and the first half of that movie is actually quite good. It's just Steven Spielberg really wanted a Godzilla moment. He wanted a Tyrannosaur running around San Diego, and it is what it is. It was not a good moment in the movie. Nothing after they leave the islands makes any sense in that movie. But there are other examples, and I understand what you mean.
You know, this even for me ties back into even the first Spider-Man movie. You know that. You know, first of all, Green Goblin is supposed to the dad, Norman Osborn. It's funny because I felt like, Amy, have you seen the original Sam Raimi Spider-Man's? Like the one, what's his name? Maguire and. That's a redhead. Give me a break. Oh my god! You know, like she came off like a scientist, like a, I don't know, like a piece of crap. I don't. I couldn't even find an analogy. It was so terrible to me. So, you know, when you're talking about like canon, you know, even the lizard wasn't even supposed to be featured that close to the origins of Peter Parker's character. And that's where I feel like this whole entire thing is, you know, for me, as for our comic book fans, you know, there are many examples that even I like where things don't follow tradition. There's, I'm sure in our future podcast we'll talk about Arrow. That doesn't follow at all, like, any, I mean, other than, like, character names, but doesn't really follow canon. But that's fine for, like, a TV series, but by all means do that. But I think it's so important when you get to the movies, okay, and you have the responsibility of this franchise, and hold on, Mike.
Hold on. I'm going to ask you a hypothetical question. I'm asking you, did you see the Hobbit Desolation of Smaug?
I have.
And Amy saw it because I dragged her to it more than once. So I'm going to ask you this, okay?
The Hobbit.
I assume you haven't read the book. I know Amy's read part of the book, but I don't think she's all the way there. So right. In the book, when they get to the Lonely Mountain, Bilbo goes down to talk to the dragon. He goes down and steals a cup, and then he comes back. And they send him back down, and he talks to the dragon, and then he comes back. And then he goes down one more time, and the dragon flies away down to Dale, which is exactly how the movie ends, right?
Okay,
no confrontation at any time. At any time in the books,
right,
between the dragon and the group of dwarves that have been setting out for the Lonely Mountain. And I'm not going to spoil it for anybody else, but it never happens in the book that there is a confrontation between the dragon and the dwarves. Not in the part that's been told so far, and not anything afterward. Now, let me ask you both. Would you have been satisfied as a movie viewer watching that movie and having the dragon fly away without ever having seen them confront the Smaug and the dwarves be confronted with each other?
Well, I think there's certainly things that don't translate well that you can do it, get away with in a book because you can use your imagination and you can take as long as you want to develop it. Whereas in a movie, you're limited by time and space, and it has to be something that's visually stimulating.
Right. So,
right, absolutely. If there wasn't the conversation between the dragon and Bilbo, it would not have made the second. I mean, you would have lost a lot there.
Well, I'm talking about specifically the crazy running around with the dwarves trying and fighting. I mean,
oh,
it was
sure. Now,
if you're talking about for a movie and needing like a climax or something, you know, to go to like the end of the movie, as long as that action, no matter what it is, for me, doesn't ruin anything for the future storyline. So, for example, for Gwen Stacy's dad dying, when he is, I'm going to have to do a little research. I forget, but he doesn't die exactly at that confrontation. He dies like much, much later. But I feel that, you know, as long as it doesn't interfere with that particular path, and if it's something that, if in any way enhances or contributes, I'm totally okay with it.
Well, that's one of the things that I like, though, about the second one, is that even though he died in the first one, they were able to bring Larry back through the flashbacks and, you know.
Should we say that this is going to get spoilery now? Because I feel like we need to just talk about the real things that happen.
Okay. Oh, God. Well, you bring up a point, Mike, then, if you're going to bring up something, then, about your, what were you thinking here?
Well, I'm just saying, so we should say this, you know, if anybody happens to be listening, we might get into spoiler stuff if you haven't seen it. So, anyway, so I assume that you don't, I know we've talked, you have issues with the Gwen death, and I know you don't like the way all the character stories reveal themselves. So talk about it. What is it that's bothering you? Let it out. You can tell us why you're having all these problems.
There is, you know, the mystique about the Gwen Stacy storyline, and I swear, like, for those who are watching this, if you haven't seen Amazing Spider-Man 2, go ahead and cut it off at this point right over here, and come back and watch it like later. Save it on your desktop or whatever, and come back and like see it a little bit later. But you know, in the movie, it's so ambiguous for the longest time as to how Gwen Stacy dies. Because, first of all, it's Norman Osborn, all right? Yeah, that's right, not Harry Osborn, Norman Osborn. Who basically, and Mike picked this up, the same clothing and everything, just booted her right off the top, and as she's falling down, you know, they kind of show, like, you're almost like Spider-Man's perspective. So if Spider-Man was here, Gwen Stacy is right over here, the camera, the viewpoint of the comic is kind of like right from here. It's, you kind of see what's downward, and you just see a big snap in the comic book scene, and he's pulling her up thinking everything's fine, but then he finds out, you know, that she basically didn't survive, and we don't know if it's from the fall. We don't know if it's from the tensile of Spider-Man's web, if she fell too far and she reached terminal velocity or whatever, and yanking up snapped her like her neck. Like we don't know like what it is, and it sends Peter Parker's character like into like this rage, and then eventually, what happened in Sam Raimi's version of Spider-Man, where Green Goblin basically sends his little glider to kill, you know, Spider-Man, and basically impales himself. That's what happened. So if you watch the movie, they take a very, here's exactly what happens. Here's the ground, you know, here's Mary Jane, and Gwen Stacy, and boom. And it's ambiguous in a way, but my goodness, there is no doubt that, like, from the sound effects and, like, whatever, from the perspective that we're at, was definitively what did it. And you never, of course you see, and this is a very raw emotion scene with Andrew Garfield. If you want to talk about, you know, probably the best acting in a superhero genre movie, where I've been, you know, affected by someone like on a level that was spectacular, but it's what you could have done more with the scene is what upsets me. You know, it's him not knowing it, and we never get to see him go into like this outside of the Peter Parker big, where he actually has to find out, like, you know, he actually has to morally find out with these powers, and that's where, you know, with the great power comes great responsibility. Even though they ruined that line in the first movie. That's my problem, is that, you know, you never get to see him go to those places. Yes, of course, there's that raw emotion about about Gwen Stacy, and I recommend for both of you, if you ever want to see where he's ever dealt with it way back, there's a great storyline called Blue, and it's a 6-part miniseries where Peter Parker basically kind of has an alone time and basically almost like a love letter kind of records into a voice recorder about the first time meeting Gwen to Gwen, you know, talking to a tape recorder long after her passing. I recommend watching for both of you. So that's my main beef about it, is that, you know, you, again, it's all about closing it off. If you can't allow like those little things, don't even bother doing it. And I think that's what's actually turning off a lot of people. If we ever get Donovan into this thing, I think he'll wholeheartedly agree about the things that you can get away with and the things that completely close you off. So am I wrong, Mike, or am I completely off, or what?
Well, so for me, you know, obviously, like I said, I don't read the comics. I do a lot of movie reading, and I had read on Screen Rant and some other places that there was that she had been seen in this outfit that was the outfit from this mm-hmm. iconic, you know, moment in the comics where she has her death scene. So, you know, Amy knows that I don't like movies that always end with all the heroes winning and the bad guys losing. And I feel like the movie was making a point about time and place and how not everything can always continue in the way that it is, and that you have to cherish what you have and enjoy the moments that you get, and that you can't be everything to everyone, and that he had to make a choice between whether he was going to be Spider-Man or Peter Parker, and it was a hard decision for him, and he couldn't have it both ways. He finally makes the decision when they're standing on top of the bridge, you know, support at the very end before Electro goes nuts and cuts off power to the city, that you know, he's going to go to London and he's going to be Spider-Man there with her. And the point is, he can't. You can't do both. He can't save the city and his family and his loves. And so, and it costs him her, and it costs him her dad in the first one. And I like that there's weight. I love Captain America, and there is a very, very deep parallel between the end of this movie and the end of the Captain America movie. I saw Captain America 3 times, and I've seen Spider-Man now 2x. They both have a slow-motion falling moment with the main character. In this one, it's Gwen Stacy, and the other one is Captain America when he's falling out of the ship. But it's both about the love between that character that's falling and the other character, and in both cases, they're saved by the person that's watching them fall. In the Captain America case, nobody dies, because in the Marvel Universe, only women that are secondary die.
Oh, my God.
They kill off a main character, and it has heavy weight for it. Now, a lot of people don't like it when the superhero doesn't save the person. I suspect that that's a big reason why people gave it the ratings. I also think that you're probably valid in your point that a lot of the comic...
Can I just say, I think it's, you sit there and say in the Marvel universe, but then you say in Spider-Man, it's the same universe.
But not for the movies, it's not. For the movies, they're separate.
But even then, just want to let you know, in the comic, Gwen Stacy comes back.
Well, I'm sure she does.
I won't get into that, but that's like, that's comic books
I will bet you $1,000, $1,000, and this is being reported, that Emma Stone never makes another appearance in the Amazing Spider-Man series.
Get your PayPal, buddy. If I see Dennis Leary showing up all over the series.
Okay, I need to be clear. I will say for $1,000 that she will never appear as a living character in a non-cast.
I'm
going to go get married and live happily ever after.
All right. Well,
I want to hear what Amy has to think about this because you know, one of the things that I hesitate to say this to you, Richie, is that, you know, this movie made $92 million. It was a little disappointing, but it made a lot of money. It's made almost $400 million worldwide. And because of that, what's important to the studio is that they get a return on their investment, and they could give a shit whether the return is from comic
and
girls who are willing to go to the movies with their boyfriends because there's a nice romance in the story.
Oh, absolutely. It's like Transformers 2 or whatever that movie was. What a horrid... I make better movies in my toilet. Morning. All right. What a terrible movie. But that movie grossed, I don't know, like how much, you know, through like 3D and other stuff. So, yeah, you're right. You know, people are going to want to see, you know, and that's that's part of the reason why I think that we all enjoyed, like, these movies so much, especially, you know, like, I, growing up, Mike, like, I don't know if you recall this, because your memory is always botchy at, I remember, like, when, like, there's always, like, that definitive summer blockbuster. Like, I remember, like, Independence Day. That was, like, the big one, like, full of stars and everything. And, you know, and these are just things to look forward to. I think this combines that love, but with another love for me, like, which is, like, comics are growing up. So let's go ahead and wrap it up here, guys, for, like, a little bit. And let's ask, like, are there any other superhero movies that we're looking forward to seeing, like, in the summer? Or are there any other movies? I'm sure we'll expect a sequel to Amazing Spider-Man 2. Not because it's going to be good, but because they're contractually obliged to do it to keep the contract. But, Amy, let's start with you. Are you looking forward to, like, any other movies off the top of your head that are going to be coming out this summer? Go for it.
I'm actually excited about Guardians of the Galaxy. I think it looks funny. I'm interested to see what they're going to do with it, though. Mike actually bought, like, 4 or 5 comics of it. So
first time I've ever bought comics for me in my life.
There you go. I hope it works, and I hope it ends up being. I mean, I think it has a lot of potential from the previews and stuff. So I'm interested. I mean, X-Men. I think that there's potential there as well. If they can make it work, I think there's a lot going on though. So it could be a big train wreck as well. But
right.
I'll be there to watch it. So either way, and that's why I think that they can get away with what they get away with in these movies, because you guys, even though you know that they're going to butcher what you love and about the story, you still go. So, you know.
Yeah. You know me so well. Mike, how about you? What kind of movies are you looking forward to seeing?
Well, so probably the two movies I'm looking forward most to seeing this year, not just summer, is the first of the climax scene, movies for the Hunger Games. Because I really loved the second Hunger Games. I thought it was really great. Another well-acted movie. And The Hobbit, the final installment of The Hobbit, The Battle of Five Armies, they just renamed it. I'm a huge Tolkien Middle-Earth guy. For the summer, for me, it's 3 big ones, and 4 big ones, and then there's a bunch of other ones that I'm really excited about. Probably the one that I'm currently most worried about is How to Train Your Dragon 2.
I was about to bring that up, too.
How to Train Your Dragon is maybe my favorite animated film of all time. It's really great, and I really was excited about it, but I'm concerned about the storyline based on the previews. I also was really concerned about the stories for the new X-Men movie upon seeing most of the early trailers, but the most recent trailer that was in Spider-Man I thought was pretty good. So I don't really know what the story is going to be, but we'll see. Some early viewings have been positive, so we'll see. For me, the big two are way out there. It's Godzilla, which could be terrible. It could be great. I don't know what to think. They've screened it now in a few places I read, and they say that the sound of Godzilla actually shakes the theater. And if I get to go into a theater and my theater physically moves because Godzilla's screaming at me, I'll be happy even if the movie's terrible. But as Amy pointed out, Guardians of the Galaxy, I think, is the big question mark this summer. I don't know if it's going to be the next Star Wars or not, but it looks like Marvel meets Star Wars meets Indiana Jones, and I couldn't love 3 things more than those 3 things, except maybe if they find a way to stick a dinosaur in it. And we'll have to see. But Groot's pretty close to a dinosaur, so I'm pretty excited about him. I think it's a very interesting summer because 2015 is going to be pretty crazy with all the movies that are coming out, and so there's a lot of sort of question marks, I think, this summer. There's a lot of big, but there's a lot of question marks. Whereas next year, I think it's going to be much more clear cut what the winners are likely to be. Obviously, Avengers will be pretty big. And so forth.
And then the following year after that, 2016, you have Batman versus Superman, which will eventually segue to the Justice League movies. I know that's a big one a lot of comic book fans want to see, which will probably get messed up. But you never know.
One's down?
Huh?
Yeah. I don't like DC that well.
Oh well, hey, God, you know what? The only if you want, go check out the CW.
You watch Arrow. I like Arrow.
Arrow is the only thing I will watch that DC related. Or I'll actually even venture to do this. Any of the animated, Justice League War, Justice League Flashpoint Paradox, even though they kind of stripped down animation on the DC side, it's actually getting it right. And that, I don't know if you guys are ready to venture into that world, but if you want good storylines based on those characters, that's actually kind of nice. Those are definitely ones to check out. Yeah, I'll agree with Amy. Definitely X-Men is going to be a pretty, and I assess that too much might be too much. Yeah, I think the entire way, I think there might be too many characters when you're trying to fuse both worlds. I see what they're trying to do. Hey. I was going to bring up How to Train Your Dragon 2. The previews for me looked like really, really good storylines. That was one of my favorite soundtracks and scores when that movie came out. Had an absolutely magnificent score. Even though I question the accents of Vikings with Scottish accents, but hey, you never know. They're kind of near each other. Transformers Age of Extinction, I think it's going to be another one of those ones. It's probably home. It's Michael Bay, and if you want something substantial, you're probably not going to watch a Michael Bay movie. You're going to get the same shots. That's going to be like whatever. Of course, Guardians of the Galaxy. You know, when I was growing up reading comics, I didn't really like, I shouldn't say I really didn't like, I didn't really know that much about Guardians of the Galaxy and any of that stuff. Mine was firmly planted on Earth, you know, like with the X-Men, X-Force, X-Factor, to an extent, some of the Marvel characters. So I think we got some great movies already coming up. So I just want to thank anyone who's watching this, you know, thanks for watching like the first podcast. I think it's, I'm sure we'll refine these things like over and over. So if this is the first one, I apologize if it was like too boring. No, I don't apologize. I think it's pretty awesome. I do what I want to do because it's America. So coming up with a couple of other movies, and we want to. But please share your opinion. If you guys can check out, we'll add those into future podcasts where you can reach us at. Maybe we'll make like little feeds and get you little interaction. But if you haven't got a chance, go out there, check out Amazing Spider-Man 2. I venture that I'll probably be in the theaters for like a lot of times. And then let you know about other movies and give us your feedback. So I just want to thank everyone for watching. Thank you both to Amy and to Mike for kind of starting out this little adventure. We hope to have many, many more in the future. And thanks a lot. All right.
All right.